So nice to have you back, Alex, on this podcast.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
And let's get started, Alex. I want to talk about what's going on with NATO and Ukraine, European Union and Russia, but we have something so strange going on in the Middle East, these attacks on pagers and walkie-talkies, and something so different that we haven't seen before. It's something new. It's a new way of making noises. I would say making noises, not winning anything on the battlefield. How did you find it, in your opinion, and how is it going to affect the global economy? How is it going to affect these companies, big companies, Western companies? Because it should have, because if Israel can do this, all of these countries would do this if they want to do.
Yeah, I think that we are yet to find out how exactly this was done. I got information from somebody who said that there was something done to batteries. You know, that there's a detonator and some kind of an explosive charge that are sealed within the batteries. I think that there'll have to be investigations so that we know exactly and where this was done. But for sure, it's not a good thing. And then when you see what they can do with walkie-talkies and pagers, it makes you wonder what they could do with electric cars, you know, and other such similar things. So it's a very, very bad thing for, you know, long-term development of these technologies and companies that supply them. People who use them for sure learned a lesson, and they will be a lot more careful, and maybe it will open the market to providers of such solutions from Russia or other countries, from Iran, that maybe will be safer. But at the same time, observing what has happened, I can't help thinking that the measure reflects a degree of desperation on the side of Israel. And the reason why I say this is because, there's been some turnover in the Israeli government, or announced turnover, you know, with the sacking of Defense Minister Gallant. That's apparently imminent. And so there's obviously a lot of recriminations going on in the cabinet and around the cabinet and in the defense establishment. There's clearly the government to military command and control hierarchy is broken at some level. So the military is no longer unquestioningly obedient to the government, and so what appears to be the case that these pager and walkie-talkie attacks came straight from the unit 8200, the Israeli spy unit. Well, if you're in their position, having access to these devices must be of some value. They clearly went through an awful lot of trouble to be sure that these devices are accessible to them, that they can tamper with them in some way. And so we can assume that they also obtain information through these devices. You know, they could see where Hezbollah militants were going. Maybe they could listen in on their conversations. Maybe they could see their messages. And the fact that they use this as the means of attack means that they blinded themselves in this sense. It means that they no longer have this access, or will no longer have this access. So, you know, this was a weapon with one bullet in the barrel, and now they shot this bullet out, and now, you know, they certainly no longer have the same kind of information gathering value from these systems that they took so much trouble to put together, because they had to infiltrate companies in, I don't know, Hungary, Taiwan, I don't know where everything. We'll know more after investigations. But this really was an extensive an extensive piece of military architecture and hardware that they managed to put in the hands of their enemies, and now they blew it up. So it seems to, you know, it seems to me that it was a desperate measure, because there's nothing much to gain from this. You know, maybe they thought, well, who knows? If we're lucky, maybe we get to blow up Hassan Nasrallah. But, you know, you went nuclear, and you probably didn't blow up Hassan Nasrallah. And now that weapon is used up and finished. And now you're blind in Lebanon, probably. And so if you fired this powerful weapon and got nothing out of it, and, you know, there was all likelihood that you would get nothing much out of it, you know, nothing strategic at any way, you know, you hurt some people, then that tells me that there's disarray in the military, hierarchy of in the defense hierarchy of Israel, that some people are taking their decisions on their own. That possibly the unit 8200 was beheaded in Lebanon in Hezbollah attack a few weeks ago. So maybe less experienced people are making these decisions and they're acting impulsively. And you know, they've diminished their intelligence gathering capability. So very bad all around, extremely bad all around. And not to forget, if there were people out there who still sympathize with the Israeli side, there are much fewer now.
Yeah. And Alex, at the same time, they're talking about sending their people to the northern part of Israel. And they've sent tanks and all those weapons to the northern part to defend them. In my opinion, they want these people to be killed by Hezbollah. It seems to me, because there is no, it's not possible to send them back home. And as long as you have this conflict in Gaza, and the other aspect would be that Hezbollah right now with this attack, they're trying to do everything to make them as angry as possible, to do as much as they can to destroy these people.
Yes, because I think that their one long shot hope of turning the situation around is to trigger a wider war, and to then get the United States involved, and then to get the European and NATO allies involved, and maybe then everybody making a common front with Israel and killing their enemies for them, particularly, you know, Hezbollah and the Iranians, I think is the last remaining hope for the Israelis. Otherwise, you know, nobody's going back to the north of Israel to live there in peace anymore. We've seen that something like half of all the startups in Israel have had their funding canceled because of the war. The economic situation is getting worse and worse and worse. And so I think that over the coming months and years, the Israelis who can will emigrate, because, you know, you can't live in these situations where a rocket might slam into your home or your business any day, where you know, the country's GDP is shrinking, where the country's industry has been now jeopardized by loss of confidence and loss of trust, because, you know, so much of Israeli economy was high tech and software and communications devices and security devices. Are they going to find the same market now that everybody knows that they could actually use these products to hurt you and to attack you? I think they're really shooting themselves in the face in every aspect of this conflict. And so maybe the only way to turn this around, if I were Israeli, would be to make such a big mess that you kind of force the major powers in the world, United States, UK, NATO, to come to your rescue and to bail you out. And so this is why I think that the Israeli leadership are behaving like a bunch of mad dogs, because they want to trigger a reflexive, knee-jerk revenge response from Lebanon, from Iran, from whoever can give them a bigger war.
Yeah. And it seems that the other aspect of this conflict was the Houthis using a hypersonic missiles to attack Israel. It's unbelievable. Just one missile and going right to the target. And don't you think that the way that the battle, because the way that they're trying to continue this conflict, it doesn't seem to have to be on their benefit. And Hezbollah didn't use any sort of this type of missile that Houthis used to attack Israel. As we know so far, Hezbollah didn't use this type of missiles. But how, when you look at this situation with the bigger picture, they're attacking, they're using weapons, and Israel was that preemptive attack with those fighter jets before Hezbollah attacking Israel. And why do they need in right now, they try to do, this was a, some, you cannot call it a real war between Israel, because detonating, as you mentioned, pagers and walkie-talkies would not change anything in this, in the calculations. But it seems to me that they're trying to humiliate Hezbollah. But in that sense, do you think that was successful?
No, I don't think so at all. You know, I don't know that they humiliated Hezbollah. You know, this is something that surprised everyone. It's not a kind of failure that you would say like, wow, you know, these Hezbollah, they're so dumb. This was so obvious that they could do this. I think they surprised everybody. And I think that in a way, this is an impressive move, because you had to set this up. And setting this up took probably a lot of planning, a lot of preparation, a lot of penetrating of these production facilities wherever they are, you know. And to put it, and then, you know, bringing this to Hezbollah, you know, you had to somehow get it to the salespeople who were selling these things. But I think that what they showed everybody is that they are desperate, that they blew up a major asset. Because maybe they wanted to intimidate Hezbollah, maybe they wanted to humiliate them. But I think that what they've shown is that they're desperate, and that they've effectively now, to a large extent, blinded themselves in Lebanon. I think this is one of those things that, you know, maybe they also wanted to just show how clever and powerful they are. But, you know, if you analyze the event a little bit, you realize this is a one-off. This is not something that you can systematically do at your choosing. This is something that you did now for a big show. You got a narrative effect. You did hurt some people. But, you know, the Hezbollah is a very large organization. And even if you hurt a few hundred people or even a few thousand people, there are many, many more. And I think that with every passing day, they're getting new recruits, especially through actions like this, where people simply, you know, can no longer tolerate the outrage. And they say, that's it. I'm going to join and I'm going to fight these people. You know, in the same way that we see these actions by Ukrainians in striking into Russia is, you know, turning tens of thousands of Russians to volunteer to serve in the military. And now, you know, what they've achieved with this is that they've turned Russian military into the second largest military in the world. Well, you know, good luck defeating that.
Yeah. Talking about the conflict in Ukraine, we have two aspects of Zelensky administration right now, the way that they're seeing the European Union and then the way that they're seeking to be part of NATO. In recently, we've learned that the new foreign minister of Ukraine is asking to, he's saying that the European Union should consider, already consider Ukraine as part of the European Union. But how do you find it right now with the situation that they're in and with the mindset of the European Union? Is that possible? Are they trying to force them? Are they trying to force the United States to put pressure on Europeans? How do you find it right now?
This whole business of accession to the EU is a cynical ploy. It's practically a carrot that's dangled in front of Ukraine's leadership to keep doing our bidding. Ukraine's accession to the EU has been discussed now for more than two decades. The first Ukraine-EU summit was held in 1997. And between 1997 and the special military operation in 2022, they held 24 consecutive EU-Ukraine summits. And in 2011, at the end of the 11th EU-Ukraine summits, they already had the accession agreement ready to be signed. They finalized it. They had it ready to be signed. But then the EU president of the EU Commission was José Manuel Barroso. They delayed the signing of the EU accession agreement, and Barroso made a speech in which he said that, oh, we need the Ukrainians to show more respect for democracy and human rights and, independent judiciary and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, they kept stringing Ukrainians along. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, you're going to be part of the EU. You're going to be part of the club. Just keep doing what we asked you to do. And then every time the Ukrainians tried to qualify for membership, they would make the requirements even more stringent. So they would say like, ah, yes, but you know, like now you have to do more on judiciary and more on democracy and more on human rights and more on this and more on that and these reforms and those reforms. And so it was endless. 25 years they've been doing this, endless meetings, endless discussion panels, 24 consecutive summits, you know, and that was before Ukraine was decimated, destroyed economically, and its population practically halved. To be talking about Ukraine joining the EU now is still more stringing them along to say, keep fighting, keep dying, keep sweeping all these men off of the streets and plunging them into the trenches on the Eastern Front, because you know you're going to get your rewards in the end. We promise. You know you're going to be in NATO. You're going to be in the EU. Just continue doing what we ask you to do. And this has been in one way or another used on every Eastern European countries who joined the EU. All of them first had to join NATO. 11 out of 11 Eastern European countries all had to join NATO. Now, nobody tells you that this is a precondition because, you know, at least overtly, it's not a precondition. But I remember in 2005, 2006, when Croatia became a member of NATO, this was discussed openly as a matter of fact that, you know, first we need to become a NATO member so that we could be then accepted into the EU. And I think that Croatia became part of NATO in 2006, if I'm not mistaken. And then we became accepted into the EU in 2013. Ukraine is light years away from either of this. And as we now know from Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski, the NATO doesn't even intend to accept Ukraine. They're just promising them, you know, giving them all these promises, but they have no intention of letting Ukraine become part of NATO. as Sikorsky said, we'll accept you, but only if you won the war against Russia.
And one of the things that he said during this, you're just talking about those.
I'm talking about the prank call, yes. Yeah. Which was it was published on 12th. What are we? A week ago, exactly.
Yeah. And one of the points that he has mentioned during this talk with these people, he said that NATO is not going to put troops officially on the ground to fight Russia. And considering this, and on the other hand, France and the United Kingdom just insisting on sending long-range missiles to Ukraine in order to hit Russia deeper into the Russian territory, do you think that they're getting to the point, or their strategy is let Ukraine fight until Ukraine is no more existed and no more is not on the map? Because the way that they're trying to give Ukraine these weapons, everything, it seems to me that Ukraine is not going, Ukraine's dying, and it doesn't seem that Ukrainians are getting this. It doesn't seem that they're understanding that the country is just dying, and nobody seems to care about this in the Zelensky administration.
Well, if they did care about this, they wouldn't be in Zelensky's administration. But I think that we're getting onto something extremely interesting, because going back to Sikorsky prank call. So, just for your viewers' context, this was a prank call by two Russian pranksters, Vovan and Lexis, which was published on 12th September this year. And they spent about 25 minutes talking to the current Foreign Minister of Poland, Radek Sikorski. One of the things that Sikorski said, because, they opened the conversation with, he thinks he's talking to former President of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko. And the conversation opens with fake Poroshenko complaining that the situation on the front is absolutely disastrous. And then Sikorski responds, I know. But then he goes into this whole laundry list of what they're doing to help the Ukrainians. And pretty much it boils down to training Ukrainian troops and then wondering how they could possibly get Ukrainian men who are in Poland to go encourage them to go fight back home. But then he also mentions that we are trying to encourage the Americans to allow Ukraine to use these long-range missiles against Russia proper. Well, what I thought was very curious is who is we when he says we are trying to encourage the Americans. And I think there's a lot to read into this, because in the same conversation, he said that his prime minister is not keen on any of this and that it's going to be a no-go. There's no interest in joining the war in any way, that even Poland shooting Russian missiles from Polish territory was shot down, and it's not going to happen. So who is we who are encouraging the Americans? I think that he's talking about a network of vested interests of which he is a part, but which are predominantly headquartered in the city of London. Because Radek Sikorski used to be a British subject. He was educated at Oxford. He emigrated to the UK as a teenager. And while he was at Oxford, he was recruited into this very, very exclusive, by invitation only, Bullingdon Club. And the person who induced him into the Bullingdon Club was none other than British former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And, the Bullingdon Club is where, the alumni of this club include Lord David Cameron, the former Prime Minister and then Foreign Minister of Great Britain, George Osborne, former Chancellor of the Exchequer under David Cameron, people like Nathan Rothschild, the current, head of the London Rothschild family. I think that Jacob Rothschild, his father, died. I'm not 100% sure now. And then, a lot of these other establishment people who have been deeply involved in a lot of these British imperial projects, like Lord Halifax, who is one of the key people who cooked up World War II and, you know, orchestrated that whole appeasement deal at Munich in 1938. And then, you know, I guess just a few days after this conversation, Keir Starmer flew over to the United States, where they really tried to encourage the United States, the Biden administration, to be on board with this new idea of striking at Russia with long-range precision missiles. And then something happened. And it seems to me that Anthony Blinken, who is also part of these, you know, Sikorsky's we, was convinced that the Biden administration would be on board. So they organized this meeting between the British cabinet and the American counterparts. And then all of a sudden it was a no. And we saw that Joe Biden was very, very irritated because Joe Biden is deeply invested in the Project Ukraine. But it seems to me that there may have been a palace coup in the United States. Because suddenly Anthony Blinken didn't have anything else to say about Ukraine. It seems that he's cut out of the loop. It seems to me that CENTCOM, or, you know, some group of military generals at the Pentagon took over the military affairs as well as the diplomatic affairs related to Ukraine and seemingly also related to Israel. And so the British and Radek Sikorsky's whole project of lobbying the United States to invest itself into escalating the war with Russia to a, you know, all-out conflict between Russia and NATO fell flat on its face. And I think that we got to such a point of danger that it may be that the power structure in the United States just changed. Now, I guess we're going to find out over the coming months, but I don't think that we're going to find out by some general coming out and saying, well, here's how things are, we took over. I think we're going to have to be looking at the conduct of foreign policy from the Biden administration and see if it really did radically change or if this was just one step back in hesitation. And then if it does change radically, then I think that indicates that there was a, you know, some people got cut out of the decision-making process and some new people cut themselves into the decision-making process covertly, you know, without announcing anything. But, you know, it's people with the guns that ultimately have a certain power. And I think that Pentagon maybe is the last place where you have sober heads thinking through the moves and analyzing the consequences of these moves. Because let's face it, the neocons are tied to the hip with the establishment in London. They work in concert and they have brought us to the verge of nuclear war. And, you know, if the nuclear war happens, it's the military people who are going to be fighting and dying and bleeding. And they may not be interested in that, particularly since Russia is not threatening the United States. It's the other way around. And so, you know, it's very simple to say, what are we doing this? We're trying to escalate the war for what reason? On whose behalf? Who gains this? We practically destroyed Ukraine and we're not going to win this war anyway. We're just risking to set the whole world on fire. Everybody's going to lose, so we're not doing this. And you people who brought us here, well, guess what? You're not making any decisions anymore. And I think that the fact that they, you know, the British have been working hard to get this arrangement. They even updated their mutual defense agreement, the MDA, to Trump-proof it. This was done very recently, that they signed a new mutual defense treaty, which the British cabinet, the British establishment kind of felt that this was a very important diplomatic win, because now the United States kind of obliged itself to come to the rescue of the British if these end up in a war against Russia. And so the, you know, they thought like, oh, well, great, now we can escalate and the Americans are obliged to come to our rescue if things get dicey. And then, you know, the next step was to encourage the Americans to also sign off on this direct attack on Russia with long-range precision missiles. And then at that point, something broke. And something broke very radically. And I'll be very curious to learn more about this because, you know, I do get the impression that we're looking at a palace coup in Washington, D.C.
I think what's so serious right now is the way that Putin responded to sending these long-range missiles to Ukraine, because during this conflict, we had a lot of attacks, drones and all of these things attacking Russia, but he has never been that serious to talk about it seriously, to talk about it rigidly. And he said, if they attack, we're going to respond. And do you think that was the reason that Pentagon changed its mind toward the conflict, or what's something else behind the scene?
Well, I think that we were looking at an escalation, and you're right. There has been a lot of attack with these ATACMS and Storm Shadow missiles and other on Crimea, on Kerch Bridge, on Belgorod and so forth. But I think that here the British were contemplating a very, very serious escalation in conducting these long-range strikes at targets in Russia at a larger scale. And then there's always the risk that some of these attacks might carry a nuclear warhead. And it could happen by mistake, or there could be. All kinds of circumstances that would later be difficult to explain. But it seems to me that the British are at the kitchen sink moment, you know, when you're ready to throw the kitchen sink at the problem, and that this was risking to get out of hand and get out of control. And at the same time, I think that there are continued communications between people at the Pentagon and their counterparts in Russia, that they actually talk to each other, and they have done so for a very, very long time. And I know that under the Trump administration, they had weekly meetings by some kind of a telephone connection. And so I think that those connections still exist, and that perhaps the Russians have warned their counterparts by telling them maybe exactly which targets are going to get hit in case of a large scale rocket attack on Russia from Ukraine or from NATO countries. From Ukraine, assisted by NATO personnel with NATO provided weapons. And I think that the Americans probably took them seriously for whatever reason. We don't know what they might have told one another, but something prompted the Pentagon to step in and put a stop to this escalation. And it seems to me that in the same go, they've also told Israel, you know, I think that might be the part of the same palace coup that, you know, they sent this general Michael Kurila to Israel. And this is also not quite confirmed. I can't figure out if this is official or not. But they sent him to Israel to say, if you provoke a wider war against Hezbollah or against Iran, meaning, you know, the provocation comes from your side, you're on your own, we're not going to come to your rescue. So I think that may be triggered kind of like this turnover within Israeli cabinet and all these recriminations, which then, you know, led to this desperate step of triggering these weapons that they put so much time and resource into preparing. Now they blew it up. So it seems to me that something very, very important changed. And I think that the recent events in Israel and the recent events in the United States related to the Ukraine conflict, to me, suggest that something in the American conduct of foreign policy changed very radically. And I think that time will tell, but again, I think we might be able to recognize these changes in the pattern of policy making rather than by any, you know, overt declaration that, hey, look at this, Pentagon's taking over foreign policy. I don't think we're going to get that kind of a press release.
The other side of this story would be what Stoltenberg said to the Times in his interview. He said that so far we have crossed all those red lines and nothing happened. If we cross this one, sending long-range missiles to Ukraine, nothing gonna happen. It wouldn't escalate the situation right now. But all those red lines that they're talking about, it's all Western red lines. Russia never talk about red lines. And even before this conflict in Ukraine started, Russia was warning, but at the end of the day, we know that when red line is crossed, Russia gonna act. They're not gonna talk about it. That's why I think in their mind, they're taking this seriously in the United States, while in the European Union, they're totally disconnected with the reality.
Yeah, absolutely correct. You know, Stoltenberg is a part of this class of people who have no idea what they're talking about. They will just, you know, it's their job to say what they're told to say, and then they say it. And, you know, we've seen people like him, people like former NATO secretary, Patrick, I forget his first name, Robertson, and a bunch of others who keep always saying like, we shouldn't feel intimidated about escalating to nuclear. You know, why should we feel intimidated? You know, that's, you know, we can maybe even possibly win it. So they're trying to encourage the people and the structures that are the decision makers to always escalate. And I think that people who are in the military, in the Pentagon, they understand that there's going to be consequences. They understand their own vulnerabilities. And they understand that they can get hurt very, very badly if Russia takes certain steps in response to this escalation. Stoltenberg and Robertson and a lot of these other talking heads, these generals that are now mainly on television screens, they are there to provide the narrative cover for whatever somebody wants done. And so I think it's better to ignore them because they're peddling the narrative. Other people are making decisions. And, you know, when the decisions change, then the narrative might change as well. But I think that Russians have shown for years now, you know, Georgia in 2008, Syria in 2015, Ukraine in 2022, that they, you know, they don't play these narrative games. They take their own security very, very serious, and they're prepared to take risks to defend their security. And, you know, if it comes to a possible nuclear exchange, meaning that some of these missiles might carry nuclear warheads, because, you know, there has been, the Pentagon has in the past ran these war games in preparing a nuclear attack on Russia. And then there was a whole project of trying to install missile launch sites inside Ukraine in the area of, not Kursk, Chernobyl and the city Kharkov, in the area of Kharkov. And the Biden administration wasn't backing off from this. They were insisting that they had the right to do this, and you know, this would effectively this could deprive Russia of their nuclear deterrent, because the idea was to launch a nuclear attack on Russian nuclear launch sites, to kind of behead the Russian military command structure, and then to weaken their ability to mount a response. And then that first nuclear attack was meant to be followed by a land invasion through Ukraine and through Baltic states. And so whether these plans were going to be carried out or not, we don't know. What we do know for sure is that the Western powers wanted to give the Russians every impression that this is what they're planning to do. And they were doing this in order to provoke Russia to invade Ukraine, which you know, they have achieved. But, you know, this is a very dangerous game of chicken, because they keep wanting to provoke Russia into escalating. But, you know, we've seen that Russia gives warnings. Please don't do this. Please don't do this. Please. Here we have a new security architecture that we want you to look at, and that we want you to sign these agreements. And the West always effectively spits into their face and dares them. What are you going to do about this? And then the Russians warned them in December 2021. They said, like, if you don't take our security concerns seriously, then we will take military technical measures to ensure our security ourselves. They said it, they did it. And now they, you know, practically vanquished the NATO's most powerful proxy army that they could hope to have in Ukraine. And so now if the Russians say, we're going to strike at your targets, it doesn't have to be a nuclear strike. You know, these hypersonic missiles pack such power that, you know, you don't need a nuclear bomb. You could launch a bunch of Kinjals or Zircons and wreak tremendous destruction and damage to NATO and to US military and to British military and German military. And so they received the warning, if you do this, we're going to respond, and here is where we're going to hit you. And so I think that the military command said, let's not do this. There's too little to gain from this adventurism and too much to lose. So it stops here.
Yeah. There is an article in Bloomberg is talking about, no matter who's going to win in the United States, at the end of the day, Europe going to be alone. And the United States would leave the European Union and Europe. The other thing was, during the debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, we didn't see that much of policy toward the European Union. But J.D. Vance gave an interview recently. He said that we are not going to take care of what's going on in Europe and in Ukraine. Europeans should pay for the reconstruction of Ukraine. Germany, he mentioned Germany. While our priority is China. And it's J.D. Vance, but at the end of the day, right now with the Biden administration in power, you see the same policy. While they've sent all those weapons to the Middle East, in the middle of all these conflicts in the Middle East, they've sent again the U.S. aircraft carriers to the Pacific, because they know in their eyes the main enemy is China right now. That's why I think all the things that they're talking about in the mainstream media, leaking through these talks sometimes, shows how Europe would be alone with the conflict in Ukraine. And they would, it seems that the United States would force them to help Ukraine in the future, or maybe continue this conflict, while their priority is China. With the conflict with China, I think the United States is getting prepared, even sacrifice Europe for the conflict with China. It doesn't seem, how do you find it right now? How do you see these events that are happening right now?
I'm not sure. You know, I think that, the relationship between the United States and Europe is between the sovereign and the vassal. And I think that to an extent, it's useful to have vassals on the continent of Europe. So I think that, this kind of relationship will continue to get cultivated. J.D. Vance, you know, this is a lot of pre-election talk. I don't know how much of it they actually mean. Nobody will pay for the reconstruction of Ukraine. This is all going to be a lot of talk. Nobody paid for reconstruction of Afghanistan. They were there for 22 years. Nobody paid for the reconstruction of Iraq. Nothing was built. Nothing is being built in the one third of Syria that the United States is occupying. This is just not part of what they do. I think that the same is going to be true for Ukraine. They're going to wash their hands and walk away. Europe will have to do with a wave of refugees that's coming probably with the cold weather this fall and this winter, because between 70% and 80% of Ukraine's power generating capacity has been completely destroyed. And so how Europe is going to, yes, in this sense, they're going to find themselves completely on their own. The United States is not going to care at all about how we cope with these refugees. And, you know, countries like France and Germany are already on the brink of collapse because of the refugees. Well, what they're going to do is what they always do. They're going to resort to the printing presses. They're going to be printing money, and they're going to be funding all these problems with freshly printed euros and pounds. And the result is going to be many, many years of stagflation in Europe and the United Kingdom. And so what that effectively means is that we are all going to pay for this through debasement of the currency. So all of our purchasing powers are going to be cut down, standards of living are going to go down, and the average European is going to be suffering. We see that in the United Kingdom, they're preparing savage austerity. They already started by cutting pensioners' subsidies for heating. And they know, according to Labour Party's own research, that this is going to end up killing about 4,000 pensioners, you know, old people dying from hypothermia. But, you know, they're ready to do that anyway. And how much will they save through this measure? They're going to save £1.4 billion. And at the same time, the refugees that they keep vacuuming up from the Middle East and North Africa and the Asian countries into the UK are costing them supposedly £8.5 billion a year. But that number almost certainly is being lowballed, because already in 2016, they were talking about £16 billion a year, or almost 17. I think the figure was something like 16.8. By now, it's only grown bigger. And they're still increasing the military budget, and they still don't want to give up their military adventurism across the world, and they're still preparing the public for military conscriptions and going to war against Russia. I mean, you know, in Britain, military generals are explicitly telling the population that they have to prepare for war against Russia. And so it's complete insanity. And I think that at some point, I think that this is going to happen, particularly if Donald Trump gets into power. At some point, the United States is going to cut the Europeans loose, and they're going to see how to do business with China. I think that if J.D. Vance and Trump come into power, there probably won't be any war against China. But if Kamala Harris gets into the White House, then we're in an awful lot of trouble.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Great. Always a pleasure, Dima. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.